You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Genevieve Kosky
and Tasha Robinson.
Keith Phipps could not be here this week because he could feel the heat coming from around the corner. Every week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we finally get to talk about Chicago, Illinois, our beloved hometown, where we're recording this podcast right now. It's a wonderful city to visit. We've got great restaurants and museums. We have Lake Michigan and Wrigley Field, the Art Institute. You can eat a deep dish pizza or see a show. It's a glittering jewel of the Midwest, and it's high time we get two cinematic Valentines to our fair city.
Scott.
What's that?
I got some bad news for you. In one of these films, they blow up the Green Mill.
What? Well, do they at least go to Wrigley? Sears Tower? The Von Steuben Day Parade?
That's all from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Well, what are our movies then?
Well, over the next 2 weeks, we're comparing and contrasting two heist movies set in Chicago. In the new thriller Widows, director Steve McQueen's long-awaited follow-up to 12 Years a Slave, the city's notoriously dirty political system figures into a complicated heist in which the widows of some professional thieves unite for a $5 million score. Set heavily on the south side, where the tonier neighborhoods of Hyde Park coexist with some of the poorest communities in the city, Widows uses an alderman race to expose systemic racial and class divides. The Chicago Way also plays a part in Michael Mann's 1981 debut feature Thief, which stars James Caan as a professional safecracker who can drill through locks more easily than he can through the city's entrenched gangsterism and corruption.
Oh well, I guess Chicago is going to live down to its reputation once again. Still, we've inspired great artists like Michael Mann and Steve McQueen, which has given a boost to our local economy. This week, we'll look at Mann's Thief and all the distinct stylistic hallmarks that would find their way into later Mann works like Heat and Miami Vice. The next week, we'll bring in McQueen's Widows and its use of genre to make larger points about our social system. Now let's all take a swig of Malort and get down to it after the break.
Ugh.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Are you clear?
You've been putting down 2-3 scores a month.
You want to put down contract scores all over the country? Working directly for me?
I am self-employed. Geisty lice. Just diamonds or cash?
Fine. I'll make you a millionaire in 4 months.
I wear $150 slacks. I wear silk shirts. I wear $800 suits. I wear a gold watch. I wear a perfect, deep, flawless, 3-carat ring. I'm a thief.
Do you think that I have been waiting for you to come along?
You're going to marry her and have some kids?
Yes.
Hey, I'm talking to you. Hey.
Hey, what? What is going on in your life that is so terrific? I'm just asking you to be with me. Go.
We got a from?
I want my money.
We new partners. We in for 10 points.
I am the last guy you want to mess with. You get paid what I say. You do what I say.
You don't know from one day to the next whether you're going to be killed, go home, or get busted.
What's wrong with you?
James Caan, Thief.
There's a funny contrast between the climactic heist sequence in Michael Mann's Thief and Jules Dassin's Rififi, which is maybe the most celebrated sequence of its kind in film history. In both films, a team of professional thieves descend from the roof after hours to access a fortune in jewels. And in both films, there's an emphasis on natural sound, rather than the music scores often used to goose up the tension in thrillers of its kind. Yet in Rififi, you can practically hear a pin drop in the theater because the men are trying to work as quietly as possible. And in Thief, they're noisy as hell, tossing furniture around so Frank, a master safecracker, can drill a hole into a particularly thick hunk of metal. There's skill involved, but it's the ultimate smash-and-grab job. Surely the comparison was no coincidence. Thief, and much of Mann's later work, owes a huge debt to Dassin, and especially Jean-Pierre Melville, whose Le Samurai and Bob Le Flambeur brought a stripped-down yet existential quality to films about the criminal kind. Yet the big robbery in Thief is also an extension of Frank himself, who isn't the type of guy to carry himself lightly. Frank is a battering ram of a man, and a performance that summons the charisma and braggadocio of his Sonny Corleone character in The Godfather 9 years earlier, James Caan plays Frank as someone whose goals are so clear that they literally fit on a postcard. If it were up to him, he'd smash and grab enough diamonds to buy a modest ranch home for his waitress girlfriend, played by Tuesday Weld, and they could raise a kid together. Any kid. He's not picky about it. Yet the world doesn't operate that way. Doing a criminal job means bringing in potentially unsavory partners. And for that matter, getting a kid through an adoption agency isn't so easy when you've got a criminal record and a hot temper. And so Frank's retirement plan has to include a Chicago mob boss, played by Robert Prosky, who has the resources to set up the biggest score of his career. And the resources, as it happens, to get him a baby, too. Frank will fulfill his end of the bargain. That's who he is. The motives and actions of others are out of his hands. Michael Mann values professionalism above all else. Criminality only bothers him if it's sloppy or dishonorable. That's why he can cast Robert De Niro as a thief and Al Pacino as a police detective in Heat and have them share a coffee together. They understand they're in the opposing roles of cop and robber, but they're united in their skill and commitment to doing the job right. Thief set the standard for the Michael Mann hero, as well as other elements that would carry over to his later films, like the synth-driven ambiance of the Tangerine Dream score, and the careful attention to how characters like Frank go about their work. Is Frank a good person? That's certainly up for debate. But as Omar Little says on The Wire, a man got to have a code, and Frank has one, even if it dooms him in the end. One of the frustrations for a man hero like Frank is that the criminal underworld naturally tends to attract its share of lowlifes, so conducting yourself honorably isn't always the best play. But Frank does it anyway, and when his honor is not reciprocated, he responds like the battering ram he is. It's not necessarily the smart play, but for a simple brute like him, it's the only play.
You don't know from one day to the next whether you're going to be killed, go home, or get busted.
Look, I have run out of time. I have lost it all. And so I can't work fast enough to catch up, and I can't run fast enough to catch up, and the only thing that catches me up is doing my magic act. But it ends, you know? It will end. When I got this right there, it ends, it's over. And so I'm just asking you to be with me.
I can't have children. I don't fit into this.
Well, we adopt.
I'm not ready. See, and I have my life, so I can't.
What? I mean, what? What is going on in your life that is so terrific? Mine's been a mess. I was just thinking, you know, that
just maybe between the two of us, that we could make something happen, something special, something really nice, you know?
Okay, so I'm extremely curious what you all thought of this film. I mean, obviously, I'm pretty well steeped in the work of Michael Mann, but I believe this is both Tasha and Genevieve, this is your first encounter with this film. And so, basically, what do you think of it?
I liked it. I felt like a lot of pressure to love it because I know how you feel about about Mann, Scott. But yeah. I did enjoy it. I was never not enjoying watching it. It's a super stylish film. It moves well. I loved seeing like this vision of Chicago, which predates my time in the city, predates me, you know, but it's a time in the city that I've seen depicted in other films, but not this way. Mm-hmm. So that was really enjoyable to see. But I think like it didn't stick to the ribs in the way I was hoping it would. And I think a lot of that comes down to the Frank character. And listening to your keynote, like kind of underlined why I didn't really connect to him, but also sort of underlined that like maybe that's on purpose. He just like feels like a little bit of a hollow center at this film. Just like his motivations just feel so basic and blunt, and there's like no internal tension in him. Like I don't get the sense that he enjoys being a thief. He's like very drawn to crime, you know. It's very kind of like you said, like a blunt instrument approach to it. Mm-hmm. And I think also watching this after Widows, where the motivations of individual characters are all super knotty and intertwined.
Yeah.
This just felt like a very pro forma approach that it worked. It worked to make the movie go, yeah. But I think it kind of kept me from connecting to the Frank character, finding him super interesting in a way that might have made the film, you know, stick a little more.
Tasha?
I wound up in a similar place, although I think Frank ends up being one of the most interesting elements of the film. It's just that he's different. He may not be complicated, but his straightforwardness mm-hmm. kind of puts him in a place that is familiar from other really interesting films, like Point Blank comes to mind, about somebody who's just a very sharpened, I want to say a sharpened bullet, which is how can you mix a metaphor in two words?
I like Scott's blunt instrument.
He's
a battering ram of a man.
Yeah. He's a sharpened battering ram. He's got he's got the pointy bit, and he just shoves it in and drives forward. And I think the specificity of what he wants ends up being really interesting to me. For me, where the film kind of falls apart is in looking back on it. It brings across tension really well, I think. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time during this film feeling a little breathless about what might happen next. Like, how is this heist going to proceed? How is this fight going to proceed? Who's going to survive this? What's going to happen in this, like, awful date between Tuesday Weld and James Caan? All of these different things. And then by the time we got to the end felt really pro forma for me. The end, to me, felt like a lot of settling scores with the mob kind of stories that I've seen over the years, some of which might have been entirely an emulation of this, but for the complexity of the film to ultimately come down to a man walking into a house and shooting a bunch of people, that was a little disappointing for me.
Right. But I mean, we can talk about the ending for sure in the choices that bring him there, which to me are quite interesting and revealing of character. But broadly speaking, I think there is a strong interest on his part, particularly in this movie, but even in Heat, which is, you know, if you consider, is to use a Chicago metaphor, that is a deep dish Michael Mann film. He is a 3-hour epic, but he likes to play with archetypes, very yes. boldly drawn archetypes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about James Caan in this movie. You know, you mentioned Point Blank is a really good example, Lee Marvin in that film, that particular type of hero, someone who is on the wrong side of the law, but goes about his business in a as honorable a fashion, as a straight shooter as you can be in that business. I mean, I think that is a pretty deliberate choice for him to use that. I mean, I mentioned Melville, who again is somebody who liked to take American noirs and do his own kind of minimalist existentialist twist on them. Jules Dassin actually had a film called Brute Force that you could have called Thief Brute Force as well, and that would have applied. I mean, I think that there's a real deliberate nature into the way this character has been conceived as simply as possible.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, listening to your keynote, like, made me feel like it was purposeful, and so like I can't quite call it a flaw, but I think like that is maybe just like kind of a personal taste thing is I straight archetype characters tend not to interest me as much as more complicated characters.
But I do tend to agree with you, though, that Michael Mann is a filmmaker who likes bold choices. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff that really stands out for me about this movie is some of the really bold choices. Mm-hmm. I love the Tangerine Dream score.
Yes.
Awesome.
It's just, it's so different. It's so memorable.
Literally, this is his first film. The first 30 seconds of the film, you know who directed it. Like, who can do that? Like, just immediately establish themselves.
It's always like just on the verge of too much. Like, there were a couple times, like, when it's just like, you know, not quite overpowering a scene, you know, but I'm like, is this too much? I think it's just right. It's just right.
It's very insinuating, and it's very, very bold. It's not a score that you're going to miss in the background somewhere. It's not a score that's trying to like sort of subtly influence you without being overt. Like, it's an in-your-face stylistic choice, and I kind of love it.
Well, and it also like features that somewhat extended sequence in the bar of Mighty Joe Young's Turning Point being played. Like, talk about your blunt, very, very upfront musical metaphors. I think that's the only like actual song with lyrics that appears in the film, but it is no less sort of in your face than the Tangerine Dream
and
stuff.
It is. It's a nice, important little, you know, Chicago moment. Mm-hmm. There's so much Chicago in this film, not just in terms of driving around in it and being in the environments of it, but like the flavor of it. You get the accents, you get the blues scene, you get all of these hangout scenes in the Green Mill, you get the car dealerships on Western Avenue,
which are still there.
Used to be made up entirely of car dealerships, and still a huge.
You get Potbelly. Did you notice that?
Yeah, that may have been the first Potbelly.
It had to have been.
Yeah,
because
I don't think it was a chain at that point. But yeah,
that completely blew my mind. I had no idea Potbelly existed.
That's hilarious. That that was like the first thing I noticed, and that seemed like Potbelly.
And you've got driving under the L stations and
you gotta have that. You gotta have the lower Wacker Drive. You've gotta have the elevated track. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of standard stuff. But he does show you some sub stuff that isn't standard, you know, and is in the neighborhood a little bit for us. That was certainly a pleasure. Just the surface of that. I mean, there's also plenty of substance to his Portrait of Chicago as well. But I kind of wanted to
up to and including incredibly abusive cops.
Oh yeah. My God! But to get kind of continue a little bit more with Frank is that what I was kind of asking myself watching it again this time is just like, what does he want? All this stuff in the postcard, this vision that he has of a perfect life, of having this woman and a kid, any kid, of living in this house. Is it, you know, of having taken care of this mentor of his played by Willie Nelson?
Who gets third billing despite being in two scenes.
I
was like, good for you, Willie Nelson.
In one of the scenes, he says nothing because he's done.
Yeah.
But he wants these things. But I wonder. But he's also strikes me as a very restless spirit. Not so, you know, or maybe. What did you think? I mean, is he somebody who's capable of turning it off? Did you get the sense like if he pulls off this one last job and he gets the score that he was promised, is he the type of person who can just shut it down?
I don't believe so for a minute. I think one of the interesting things about his dream, his postcard, his literally postcard picture life here, is he believes on some level that like once he has this list of bullet pointed things that he's represented in dream board form, long before vision boards were a thing, he thinks that he'll be able to turn it off and he'll be happy. And we kind of get that one scene of him sitting in the glider with Tuesday Weld, like holding her in his arms, and he seems at peace. I just don't get any sort of feeling that that's a long-term thing. I think it's something that he's invented for himself. And I think that disastrous date thing with her, where she does end up deciding to go ahead and go with him. Mm-hmm. But his idea of romance is showing up 2 hours late to a date, like bodily forcing the woman that he showed up for into a car and like yelling at her, like, let's get this romance on the road.
Yeah.
I don't think that he's cut out for, and when he wants to adopt a kid, it's like yelling at an adoption worker about how he's willing to take a black chink kid. I mean, he has a vision of things he wants to acquire, but his way of acquiring them, he's so much subtler when he's stealing jewels than when he's trying
he's
to.
Not, and he isn't subtle when he's stealing jewels either. He's got a drill, basically.
He's got like a 10-foot flamethrower.
But he has so much more patience with the 10-foot flamethrower or with a giant drill press in the opening scene than he has with anybody who's standing in the way of, like, basically, it's like he's got a shopping cart and he's like, pick up woman, put in shopping cart, pick up baby, put in shopping cart. And anything that interferes with that is just infuriating.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that in terms of his, you know, picture postcard life and it feeling like, you know, he says he was, what, 20 when he when he went to prison, and like, it was like in his early 30s when he came out. Like, he definitely, he was in prison during the period in your life where, you know, culturally you're expected to acquire all those things, you know, a significant other, children, a house, you know, like that's supposed to have happened for him by the time he got out of prison. And I think maybe he was sort of projecting the loss of being in prison onto this like very basic to-do list. I don't necessarily agree with your certainty, Tasha, that he can't turn it off and that he couldn't just walk away from this life of crime. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, is like, I never get the sense that he's good at, I mean, he is good at what he does, but it doesn't feel like a passion, you know, like it, I feel like in a lot of heist movies, you get this like ultimate pro character. And even if they may want to walk away, there's something that that keeps them in some sort of love of the game, some sort of like, I'm good at it, you know, like some sort of pride in what they do. And I just never got that from Frank. And that's what I kind of meant about there being no internal tension in him. It's like this is just a means to an end for him.
You know what I think is a weirdly anomalous moment in the film, but is critical, is when the cops are beating the crap out of him. He says to one of them, why don't you work for a living? Like, you could do scores too. You have all the information. It doesn't feel like he's accusing them because they're beating on him. He's accusing them because they're basically the same as criminals, but he doesn't consider their version of crime to be work.
Well,
the version that he does is a legitimate employment. And it's like he's basically saying, you know, I go to the office from 9 to 5 every day. That doesn't mean I love it, but that's what my work is.
It's like a
is.
Trade, but not a calling.
No, well, no, yeah. But no, what I think what he's saying to them is that they're scoundrels. That because the one thing that Frank is he's completely honest about what he is, a thief.
Mm-hmm.
That is what he does, and he does it, and he makes it. He makes this deal for this much of a score, and the person fencing the jewels gets this much, and his team gets this much, and he's going to pull off that job, and he's going to do it, you know. But when you're a cop, and you want a piece of the score, and that's what you're in there for. I mean, that is not doing a job properly. I mean, I think that's kind
of honestly,
that's so much a Michael Mann theme. To completely close the book on the whole, would he stop cold or not? I'm kind of convinced that he could stop cold, almost based again on the Mann character as it's gone through different iterations. I mean, because I think you have to have a certain amount of discipline. You know, he appreciates discipline, which Frank does have, at least certainly in his job. And you think about the discipline that, say, De Niro's character has in Heat, and I think in both cases it's like they can cut it off if necessary. You know, the whole line about, you know, being able to drop everything in 15 minutes when you feel the heat coming around the corner, and heat, like they can drop it. And the other thing is that postcard comes back in Collateral. Do you remember Collateral?
Mm-hmm.
With Jamie Foxx's character has the cab driver has a postcard of this tropical place or something that he has an ambition to have his own line of fleet of cabs or limos, and that is going to be his ticket to this other life. And so I think there is a legitimate pursuit of a goal on both of their parts, and maybe just a hint in Thief, like when they go off after the big job and go to the beach and play, that maybe he could do it. Maybe this is what he's living for. I don't know. So I waver. I think he can kind of go either way on that question.
I mean, it is
a way to not be a tiebreaker, Scott.
It is sort of a point.
I'm gonna say I'm leaning towards yes, he can give up the life.
The movie leans in an ambiguous direction, ultimately. I mean, in the end, I believe that we are meant to expect that he does not go and find Tuesday Weld. Like, he has told her it's over, it's done.
Yeah.
And like, he destroys his life and walks off into the mist. I don't think that's meant to be like him going off to put the pieces of his life back together. He has literally burned down his life.
Yeah.
And crumpled up the postcard.
And crumpled up the postcard, which is very symbolic of like letting go of this dream. But like, what he's off to do next, you don't know. Like, is he just going to go back into the profession? Is he done? Like, is he going to go kill himself? I mean, what do you do after destroying everything you worked for? It's an ambiguous thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like the movie is similarly meant to be kind of ambiguous about if this life had let him move ahead in something approximating an honest direction. like where he would have gone, but it's just endemic to the profession he's in that it's not going to let him do that. So it never really mattered what his choices were, because he was never going to have the choice to make.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ending is almost like Taxi Driver without the denouement in a way. Like there's like without the ironic, without really knowing what happens next, because I think the intention going in is like, I'm gonna just kill everybody. like this is just a massive life ruining betrayal. I refuse on principle to accept the terms I've been offered, and this is my response, being the battering ram of a man I am, is to lay waste to this dream that I had, and also lay waste to these people who have completely betrayed my trust. So I think that's kind of powerful, though it becomes ambiguous the fact that he survives that onslaught. Like, what, you know, the question of what happened.
Yeah, like the fact that he put on a bulletproof vest to do that in the first place, like that. Begs a question.
I didn't even remember that.
Yeah. I mean, he takes off, like, he, like, tears off his shirt, and you, like, see him, like, touching the bulletproof vest. Okay. You know, I mean, he got shot more or less in the chest and walked away. So, like, it indicates some, you know, measure of self-preservation. But why? You know, yeah. like what is he preserving himself for?
I mean,
what's the plan?
It's, I don't think that necessarily indicates planning a future so much as it, like, he knew he had to get through this business. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, like, he, when we see the level of preparation that goes into his jobs, this is another job. Like, of course he's gonna have like scoped out the house, and he's gonna know the exits, he's gonna know where the men are, because when he comes out of the house, he's prepared to be charged by a bunch of men with guns.
Yeah, I guess in that context, it's just he wanted to be able to survive long enough to get the job done.
Yeah, he needed to, in order to finish them all off, he needed to be able to take a few bullets, because it was probably inevitable he was going to take a few bullets.
Trivia question for you. Who is the actor in the non-speaking role who shoots?
Dennis Farina?
Dennis Farina.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't
that's,
that awesome?
That's not trivia. I was like, cool, it's the minute, like, this very first scene, I'm like, hey, it's Dennis Farina.
I know. This is before Dennis Farina was Dennis Farina. He was just some guy from Chicago.
He was still Dennis Farina. That hair, man. He's so Dennis Farina.
I will give you some trivia. Who is the mechanic? I believe he's the one who briefly speaks. Chicago person, but probably not. No, Del Close.
Oh, really?
Yep.
The improv guy.
Yep. Founder, more or less came up with a long form improv here in Chicago at the IO Theater, I believe. Big name in Chicago improv and all improv.
Yeah,
the Del Close Theater.
Proper. So, which brings me to this question: how does the city of Chicago figure into the action? What do you think of this as a Chicago movie?
I mean, it works really well as a noir setting. You know, especially in those sort of opening scenes with the rainy streets and the high contrast, you know, lighting. Like, it looks great. You know, but it's recognizably Chicago. But again, to go back to this idea, it is also kind of archetypal, you know, and the city plays that part really well.
I was a little flippant about police brutality, but Chicago of this era did have a humongous reputation for police brutality. This was the John Burge era. This was the era when cops were pretty routinely known to torture suspects into confessions. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that the way they handle the police in this film is meant to be like directly tied into just Chicago's reputation at this time.
Well, I mean, and also just this collaboration between the cops and gangsters. Mm-hmm. It's kind of remarkable to see this film where, you know, he makes this deal with the Robert Prosky character, and he's being surveilled by the police at this point, and you're thinking he's just fallen into this larger scheme that they've got, they're gonna rope in him and Prosky and his whole operation. That's really not what's going on at all. Like, they're there to protect Prosky and to get the surveillance is about getting their piece of the action. I mean, that's a whole nother story, really. I mean, to have that kind, that level of corruption is so great, and it reinforces these two elements, the gangsterism and the police corruption. They just end up reinforcing and strengthening each other and crushing the little guy, which in this case is a criminal, but still, it's interesting to see that work that way. It feels true to me.
I mean, the little guy is Jesse. It's Tuesday. Well, I mean, she's the one who gets ultimately crushed, right?
In that her hope for life is spoiled.
I don't know how ultimately crushed she is.
She gets the kid.
We can discuss that separately. Like, I don't want to steamroller over the Chicago discussion. I want to loop back to Jesse, because I think there's a lot
I do too.
to explore in her. But there's also just this particular feeling of mobbed upness, like this particular view of what they used to call the Chicago outfit, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of mob that wasn't, you know, so much a cinematic idea of the mob. The mafia is based around large Italian families. Mm-hmm. And I think the Chicago crime syndicates tend to be more based around the Al Capone ideal. You've got a lot of pudgy white men. Mm-hmm. Possibly surrounded by people of color, but it's much less based in like street gangs running drugs than it might be in LA. It's much less based in crime families than it might be in New York. It's based around Midwesterners. So you've got a bunch of pudgy white men with families who live in the suburbs and are quietly running crime from their basements. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a fairly uniquely Chicago way of looking at organized crime.
I love Robert Prosky's performance. It does kind of fit into what you're talking about. Because like he's threatening, but he never really comes across as overtly threatening, you know, like
until he does.
Yeah.
Boy, is it a scene when he does.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What yeah. A great, what
right.
A great
yeah.
Moment.
But he doesn't like, you know, he's almost like sort of an uncle, you know, like a mm-hmm. shady uncle figure, you know, and it fits into this idea of sort of crime as collaboration with the city. You know, it's not, he's not like an enemy of the state or the city, whatever you want to call it. He's part of it. He's part of the family, and he's the shady uncle of the Chicago family, you know?
Yeah, it's perfect casting, really, because he does have that right of avuncular uncle mm-hmm. thing going, and he has the calm of someone who knows he has all that power. I mean, mm-hmm. he doesn't have to
flex
at all, and he also realizes that he's got one over on Frank from the beginning. I mean, he can get to that point where he betrays him and expect Frank to fall in line, because the cost of not falling in line is pretty steep. You know,
he's so shady, though. Like, it's just your crime films. Crime films are so often about hubris and overreaching, you know, doing that one last job that you shouldn't do, and trusting that one person that you shouldn't trust, and getting sloppy and spending the dough, or talking about the crime in public when you shouldn't. And in this case, the hubris is all Leo's. Like, Leo could have had a really good thing going, and he chooses to screw it up because he feels he has so much power, like nobody should question him. Nobody should question the fact that he basically hired an uber professional for a job and then just completely stiffed him at the end. he stiffs him on the payout. He treats him with contempt. And then he's like, and you should be happy for me because I took all your money to invest into my businesses. And there's totally going to be a payoff. Like, never mind that you said we weren't going to deal it that way. You should smile and take what you get for the work that you did. And the whole thing could be avoided. If he dealt straight with Frank, they would be rolling in millions of dollars, and instead just everything ends up broken and burning.
I think he's comfortable, though, just anticipating that Frank is going to fall in line like everybody else.
Sure.
But I mean, this happens.
That's what hubris is.
But I don't think it's hubris. I think it's cold calculation, because that's what's supposed to happen. I think about this last season of The Deuce was the same way with the main character on that. It's like he would like to get out. He's got enough resources to do so. He wants to get out of certain aspects of the business, which he finds unsavory. But it's like, nope. You know, we're just not going to let you do that, and you're going to have to live with that. And what all of the moral baggage that comes along with it, there's nothing that can be helped because you do a great job, and we want you there. And we're gangsters, and we can say that. And so, I mean, I think there's kind of a, I think he's just certainly taken by surprise that Frank, you know, is able to do what he does. You know, I mean, because even if Frank says no, they have him outgunned and outmanned. I mean, what kind of power does he have? I mean, it's extraordinary that he's able to pull off what he does. But I think in Leo's case, it's just, you know, I think he just anticipates either Frank is going to fall in line because it would be fatal for him not to, or they just kill him.
Yeah, but that doesn't pan out. And that's what bothers me. I feel like I need maybe like more, despite the fact that I said, you know, clearly Frank prepares for his final shootout. Like, he's got the vest, he's got the plans. I would have liked to have seen more of that, because in the end, what he does is he walks into the house of the guy who has all of the guns, and a fair bit of cunning, given that he sees what's going on and gets out, mm-hmm. And just shoots everybody. And there's not really a lot presented to show like how he gets away with that apart from being a protagonist and being clever and possibly Leo just being too arrogant to see it coming. But I mean, in the end, we're told that he's this consummate professional, that he's Mr. Wizard. And then in the end, he gets his way through like very blunt. I walk in and shoot some people.
Yeah. But I also think he's, you know, there's a, I mean, there's preparation, but there's a certain rececklessness and like a nihilism to that.
Oh, that's sure. True.
I mean, nihilism, I think, is a word that kept popping into my head with his whole thing, you know? Throughout, I mean, he has that little, you know, speech about nothing, you know, with the Tuesday Woe character, you know, like,
really good point.
Yeah. And it all kind of comes back to that feeling I had of this, of being just sort of this empty hole at the center of this movie of like what is driving him, you know? And, you know, it feels like everything we see or we're told is driving him is just one level above center. You know, there's not like a core drive to him.
I guess, but I mean, I think what keeps him from being, what makes him human, I think, is James Caan, though. I think Caan is just is such a explosive actor. I mean, someone who is feeling every moment in a very intense way, has a very strong reactions to things. You know, if Sonny Corleone were less of a screw up, then he would be Frank. You know, I mean, they both run hot. That's just their way. And, you know, I think Caan pulls that off. You know, that's his one, you know, I've seen him do some pretty nuanced performances. There's a movie he did a couple of called The Rain People, where he's just gives a very beautiful, quiet performance. But like, you know, this is him. This is what you expect from James Caan. And I think there's kind of, you know, there's a lot of humanity to that I think enriches a character that is, you know, on paper and in concept, pretty simple.
I think what makes him human is Okla, Willie Nelson's character. Mm. And I think that maybe the real turning point in the film is his death, even though that is, it's such a weirdly small role and such a small scene. The scene where the two of them are talking together in the prison has more of a sense of passion and affection than anything that ever happens between Frank and Jesse. And it's actually kind of weird. The way that that scene, that conversation is shot, where they have their heads really, really close together, and they're both looking at each other with the love light in their eyes. I like, as soon as they started talking, I thought, oh, these guys used to be lovers. Because there's a weirdly romantic element to just the way they look and talk to each other. And there's a warmth to both of them. And I feel like probably what we're supposed to get is just, you know, Willie Nelson is doing his Willie Nelson thing. Like, he's a warm and compelling guy. And I think James Caan is maybe responding to that. But the way they talk, like, I know they're old friends. I know that he's his mentor. I know that he cares about him a lot. But there's a level of emotion there that I never saw between Frank and Jesse. And when Frank tells Okla, you know, here's my plan. Like, I'm currently dating this girl. We're going to get a baby. Like, the whole exchange between them just really sounds like, I'm doing the thing that you're supposed to do and it's going to work out. And Willie Nelson's like, yeah, that's cool. I kept wondering, especially given the backstory of just like the horrors of jail, if the two of them were like more than friends in jail and that they forged an emotional relationship. I am not sure that Michael Mann would support that reading. It's entirely in the acting for me. But I do think that they're meant to have a connection that is fundamentally important to his life. Mm-hmm. And when Okla dies, something changes.
I think that's a good point. I wouldn't go quite so far as to say there's any kind of like intimacy beyond this long relationship they've had, this mentorship, this closeness. And you can compare that to his relationship with Jesse, which is on the fly. It's on the fly too, yeah. Right? It's like, okay, this is good. This is like this person. This is the person. She's going to take me to whatever. He's going to help me achieve this goal that I have. It's not like he doesn't have feelings for her, but there's a definite contrast in terms of the depth of those feelings between how he feels about Oakland and how he feels about Jesse, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how Frank and Jesse's relationship is introduced. You know, when he talks to her for the first time in the movie, it's not the first time he's spoken to her. You know, like there's an implication that they know each other. He presumably sees her frequently. You know, we don't know if it's their first date or, you know, third or fifth or whatever. You know, like they have some sort of established relationship, but we are not given any clues really precisely how far along that relationship is. So when we get to that scene between the two of them, that bad date scene, which I actually really like, and like when it was over, I was like, I should have hated that. Why didn't I hate that scene?
Oh yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah. I think the answer is Tuesday Weld. I think she was fabulous in that scene. But
and I also think it's just spectacularly beautiful, like this, like where he sets it and the way it looks. It's just so, it's such a gorgeous scene. But go ahead.
To reach that scene without like firm knowledge of what led up to it, without being told explicitly, I don't know how I feel about it still. I mean, I only watched this movie, you know, a handful of hours ago, so I'm still kind of like putting it together in my mind. But I think it's interesting the way the relationship progresses in this movie.
I think that progression condensed into this scene is why I end up loving the scene. Because for me, it's not necessarily the acting, although the acting is good. It's not necessarily the setting. It's the expectations I had based on how it started to build and where it went instead. Because the where he shows up and he's 2 hours late and she's like, you know, we're done. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for me to put up with this. You don't respect me. And he physically throws her into a car and she gets out and other people try to help her and he grabs her and throws her back in and takes her somewhere and like forces coffee on her and tells her what to think. All of that reminded me so much of Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway in 3 Days of the Condor, mm-hmm. and how he basically assaults and kidnaps her and takes her hostage, and so she falls for him. And just that whole dynamic, we did a whole list of them at for an inventory at the AV Club of people, women falling for men who kidnap and assault them. And it's a really gross trope. So here, as soon as he throws her into the car, I was like, oh boy, here we go. And like within two scenes, she's going to be falling for him because he's so manly and dreamy. And instead, she keeps standing up for herself. Mm-hmm. She does not budge on, like, I am not interested in dealing with this. And it tells you so much about his character, how he escalates, how he gets so frustrated because she won't get with the program. What are you doing in your life that's better than living up to this weird fantasy that I have? Like, just do what you're told. And she just keeps pushing back on it. And when she does give in, it's not out of a feeling of romantic attraction to him. It's because he basically offers her something that she's never had and she wants. And when the two of them exchange horror stories, those horror stories are really horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, but like the little glimpse we get of her background, it's like, oh, I can see why you might like be drawn to a somewhat transactional, stable or supposedly stable, safe relationship,
which is possibly an illusion. Like he basically ends up saying, like, look, and we don't know each other, but I want to make this picture happen. Do you want to be in this picture? And she's like, that picture looks pretty good to me. Not you look
except
pretty good to me.
Except for all the dead people.
Yeah, what's with the dead people over here? Oh, there's actually an interesting story behind that. So
the answer is nihilism.
What the nature of that exchange ends up being is A, so far what I was expecting from what I was expecting it to be, and B, so unique. Like, this is just, I think of maybe a movie like Mad Dog and Glory, where a woman basically agrees to be in a relationship with somebody she does not care about in the slightest for transactional reasons. And I don't know. It's just there's a small enough number of those kinds of things. I don't think she ever really gives up her identity. I don't think she ever really gives up like where she came from or what she wants. And that's why in the end, when he sends her away, she's pretty clearly devastated that it's over, but I don't think she's in any way destroyed because I think she was always expecting it
to
happen.
Fair. Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, one note I would make on top of all that, which is, I'm not, you all have impacted very well, and I'm not stepping on any of it. Is that
please do mansplain the female character to us.
M-A-N-N.
Giving that a golf clap.
It's interesting that the length of a scene like that, the amount of time that man is willing to devote, which is ostensibly a tight, whatever, two-fisted, you know, heist movie, and send you on this journey with these characters for that length of time. That's very unusual. And then he follows that up with other things that are unusual to see in a movie like this, which are just planning, which is just like, how do we do this job and what do we need and who do we talk to? What's different about it than other jobs? You know, it just, it's interesting what gets man's attention, because when something gets his attention, he gives it, it gets his full attention, and he really works it as hard as he can, and so you end up with some unusual touches, like how long would that scene be? 15, 20 minutes or something like that? That's a very long scene.
The one between the two of them?
Between the two of them. I mean, and that is nothing I think you would anticipate in a movie like this. So, you know, kudos to you, Michael Mann, making your first movie. But we'll have more to say about Michael Mann and Thief next week when we compare it to Widows. But first, a break and some feedback. Now it's time for feedback, when our listeners weigh in with their responses to recent episodes and anything else of the world of film. First, we have to start, though, with a terrible, terrible, terrible mistake that Tasha made.
Really? Was it a terrible mistake that I made? I'm going to throw it all on Keith in absentia.
I was there for it. I guess it's probably my mistake for not even...
It was my mistake for not being there to correct you all.
Okay.
Basically, it's everybody's mistake.
What was this terrible error, Tasha, that you made?
Oh, well, recently when we were discussing The Other Side of the Wind on Netflix for our pairing of Other Side of the Wind with Shirkers, I was rambling on about how my deep-seated love of John Huston's voice and how he will always be Gandalf the Wizard to me. I believe Keith said, in the Bakshi movies, and I said, yeah, because I have a terrible knee-jerk habit of responding in the affirmative when somebody seems to know more than I do about a piece of filmic trivia.
To be fair, Keith is often that person.
Keith is like really... I'm going to back up and say I have a knee-jerk habit of responding to him positively because he is so much more on the ball on that. Usually I have to look it up.
Tasha, do you know that Dennis Farina is in Thief?
What? Next, you're telling me that Del Close is in Thief. This seems hinky. I'm going to go look this up. He is in. John Huston was in fact Gandalf in the Rankin Bass Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit movie. Mm. And I apparently quoted him accurately, but placed him in the wrong movie. So a little unfortunate about that. But strangely, we did not get a huge wave of emails telling me that I'm an idiot. So I would like to thank everybody who did not well actually me on John Huston's casting, and I would like to invite you all to join me on a grand adventure.
Okay, well, thank you for that.
Correction,
Tasha.
Issued.
Correct, but it's much harder to issue corrections on podcasts than in, but it's more entertaining. So we thought we were through with A Star Is Born. But A Star Is Born wasn't through with us.
It just wanted to look at us one more time.
It did. Genevieve, what's the latest?
Ben in Houston wrote a very long email about the suicide that ends the films. We can't read it in full, but here's an excerpt. Ben writes, I wanted to write in to talk about a subject in both Star Is Born movies, which you mentioned that you didn't have time to get to, which is the difference between how the suicide is treated in both films. Y'all captured well my problems with the way that Jackson Maine is so much more overbearing and self-serving than Norman Maine in the other film. But one of my chief complaints is that the suicide at the end of the most recent film is completely 100% unambiguous. I watched all three previous Star Is Born films before I saw the new one, and in all three, the suicide of the older male is fairly ambiguous. Now, maybe with the first two, this was due to the morality clauses and Hays Code era reasons, but what I loved so much about it was that the man saw that his very existence was a burden on the woman and her attempts at happiness and career achievement. As such, it's not so much of an idea of, if I kill myself, she'll move on, as it's more, if I go away, she'll move on. It would be better if one day I just wasn't here anymore. By making the suicide unambiguous, it makes it more pointedly a statement of you made me do this, particularly since Jackson does it while Allie is having a big concert where he is supposed to be there. It makes it once again entirely about him, where in the other films the sacrifice of the man is to say I'm going to die, but in a way that you could potentially move on. Of course, the tragedy is that at least in the first two films, the final line implies that she will always carry that tragedy with her and that he really perhaps did her more of a disservice than he realizes. In this version, it is almost purposefully saying, I'm going to kill myself because you can't possibly live without me, even though the intention is supposed to be, I want you to live without me. So that's letter, but Ben also gave us his definitive ranking of all four versions of A Star Is Born, and it is, starting at the top, 1954, 1937, 2018, 1976.
Okay.
Coincidentally, that's also the combination to the lock that on the safe that Frank is breaking into at the beginning of the film. So if he had realized that, he could have just saved himself a lot of drilling.
So I think this is a good letter, though. I would say that unambiguous. I think it's clear that suicide is being committed. But the point that he makes about going away, not being anymore, it's definitely a much different type of suicide, a much mm-hmm. different type of death. And I guess maybe he's thinking it's ambiguous in terms of how it might be interpreted by other people.
No, I think he's saying it's ambiguous in terms of the drownings could just theoretically not
right,
be
that's
deliberate.
What I'm saying. Yeah. But I mean, the people who would like outsiders could potentially see that as you think that even she would see that as possible.
Oh, I think even the audience could see it as possibly not suicide.
Oh, okay.
Like you'd have to stretch for it, but I think it's in a Hays Code kind of way. But yeah, I think it's also meant to be, you know, for her in all cases. If it's left ambiguous for her, she doesn't necessarily have to contend with he did it because of me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's also left ambiguous for the rest of the world within the film. You know, like Norman Maine died in a swimming accident is different from Jackson Maine was found hanged to death
in his garage.
Yeah, yeah, like that's something that can't be spun, you know, mm-hmm. by the shady studio PR guy. So Allie will always have the shadow of her husband definitively killing himself, whereas Esther lost her husband under tragic circumstances, but it maybe wasn't suicide.
I feel like Bradley Cooper's character in Star is Born is just in enough pain that he's not really thinking about these nuances. Like, I really don't think that either the film sells the idea of he wants her to be tortured forever or that he's trying to make it all about himself by doing it during a concert. I think he's a tortured soul. I think he's an addict, as they all are, and he's had a troubled past and a troubled family life. And I think that when he does it, he's not thinking about destroying her future. He's thinking about trying not to sabotage her future. I think that that's all there is to it. There's a lot more in this letter specifically about the imagery used and how it's used. And a lot of that I specifically didn't agree with, which I think kind of pushes me a little bit against this interpretation. Mm. I think he's right in saying it's unambiguous here and that just does change the math a little bit. I just disagree about what it implies as a result.
You gotta take our word for it. Ben really drops the ball in part of the letter that
we'll put the letter on Facebook. It's long and it like so many things. Suicide is just one of those things that, depending on your life experience, you're probably going to have very personal reactions mm-hmm. to. Death in general the same way, but I think suicide even more so. You're going to have very personal associations, and they're going to affect how you see how it's portrayed. And so, you know, he may be interpreting based on his experiences. I know I am on mine. I think everybody's going to see it a little different way. I wouldn't be surprised if Bradley Cooper was seeing it a specifically different way. But for me, the language of the film does not say this is about him selfishly trying to hurt her.
But there is definitely a difference between just being sort of washed, carried out to sea, and then hanging yourself, which mm-hmm. is so evocative of like Kurt Cobain, you know what I mean? Kurt Cobain
didn't hang himself.
No, he did. But, you know, just like being, you know, he was in wasn't a garage, but it was something, guest house. And John, I mean, it's not that the two incidents, they kind of rhyme a little bit to me anyway. Mm. But just being carried out to sea, I mean, that's about as graceful as it gets. But we had other good emails about A Star is Born and The Other Side of the Wind and other things like that, but we'll save some of those for later. We always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations so we can feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll fast forward to present-day Chicago to look at another big heist in Steve McQueen's new thriller, Widows. Look for that Tuesday, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow,
and follow us on Twitter at Next Picture Pod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we're going to change cars like other podcasters change their shoes.